get started with the beginning of the process, and that is the first of our 15 steps of the Seder. We know is the mitzvah of Kiddush, which on Pesach night is a little bit different than every other night, but it's the first of the four cups of wine that we drink, or grape juice if you're into grape juice. So why are there four cups of wine? We're going to try to make this somewhat interactive. What's that? Right, that's what Rashi says. Rashi quotes that it's from the four Lashonos of Geula. But if you look in the Talmud Yerushalmi, which is an alternative to the Talmud Bavli, they give you another suggestion. They say, look in the story of the baker and the butler in the end of Sefer Bereishis, and you will find the word kos paro four times. So because it says kos in the context of paro four times, we're going to have four cups of wine at the Seder. Make sense? Yes? No. Doesn't make any sense at all. Come on.
Where does it say kos?
In the context of the story of the butler and the baker,
It
says the word kos four times. Kos paro biyadi vo akaches akos. So the Talmud Yerushalmi says it says four times kos in the context of the story of Yosef and paro. So we're going to have four cups at the Seder. So right off the bat, you're thinking, yeah. Beautiful. So I think that's a big connection, and that notion that Yosef was the beginning of how we got down to Mitzrayim is a big piece of the puzzle. How do we get down there in the first place? Because of Mechiras Yosef. I'm sure now many of you are thinking, wow, this is not the only place that Yosef appears at the Seder. We move just two steps later, and we find ourselves dipping something into something else. Well, it depends. If you're dipping bananas or potatoes or whatever it is, you're dipping it into salt water. But says Rabbeinu Manoach in his commentary on the Rambam, he says, when did we have somebody else dipping something? That's it. The brothers dipped his coat. And what was his coat made out of? What's the Hebrew word for his coat? Pasim. Says Rabbeinu Manoach, kar pas, ksones pasim. Yet another reference to the story of Yosef. And then there's another remarkable one. It was brought to my attention by my teacher, Rabbi Jacob J. Schachter. There's a very bizarre Gemara in Pesachim that describes how the Jews used to wrap up the Korban Pesach after they would prepare it in the Beis HaMikdash, and they would put it in the skin of the animal and they would throw it over their shoulders. And the Gemara describes that it's kemin taya. It's like a taya. And Rashi says, socharim yishmeelim. Arab merchants. Arab merchants. Where have we seen Arab merchants before? So obviously, it's another oblique reference to Yosef at the Seder. So one element is this idea of how we got down there. It's like the Laurel and Hardy line. You know, this is a fine mess, a nice mess you've gotten us into there, two gears so. I used to think it was fine, but if you look online, they say it was nice. So this is a fine mess you've gotten us into now. That's how we got in. But perhaps there are other elements in the story of Yosef as well. How did Yosef get into the pit in the first place? Well, there was a little bit of a disagreement in his family. So says Rabbi David Foreman, well, let's close the circle here. How do we eat the Korban Pesach? Who eats the Korban Pesach? Bingo. Sel lebeis avos. Ideally, it's with a person's family. If you could theoretically eat an entire lamb by yourself, we paskin that that's permitted. That's your yotze if you ate the whole lamb by yourself. But ideally, that's not supposed to be eaten alone. It's supposed to be eaten in a group, ideally with your family. So what we have here is the whole family coming back together. That's kind of one piece of the puzzle, getting out of Mitzrayim, realizing that we have to get our families, everybody's family has to get back on track. That's one piece of it. Maybe another level is looking at Yosef in terms of a model of Geula, a model of redemption. It wasn't so easy for Yosef. He was sitting in a pit and he thought there was no hope. And the next thing you know, HaKadosh Baruch Hu takes him out of there. The whole notion that Geula could be sudden, it also could be filled with ups and downs. You know, one day he's up, and the next day he's back in the pit, and the next day he's up. So Yosef, I think, is an important motif, excuse me, to keep in mind for the Seder. So that's something that we can begin with in terms of Kaddish and Karpas. Okay, so now we're going to start the Magid. That's the main part of the Seder. What's the most important... What's the point of the Seder, if I were to ask you? How would you summarize? What is the point, the goal? What are we supposed to accomplish at the Seder? The Magid. So tell the story. Why do we have to tell the story?
So that everyone feels that they were
part of the story.
Okay, so why is it important that everybody feel important? What's the point of remembering this story?
That's how we started as a nation.
Okay, so one component is that's how we started as a nation. So it's a birthday party for the nation. Anything else? Because maybe if that was just the concept, we wouldn't have to go to such great lengths. Any other reasons why are we telling this story?
What keeps us going.
Okay, keeps us going. We'll get that in a little bit. There's a national component, but there's something else as well. Right. What? What are we telling our kids? That God took us out of Mitzrayim, and He's running the world. We often struggle. I can't speak for anybody of the Nashim Tzidkaniyos here, but I often struggle to see God in the world. It's not so easy. So you look around, it's very hard to find God. It's a challenge. So I had a group of young women today. I was studying with them in the academy. I happened to have this group, and we were talking about how do you believe in God. So one girl was like, well, you know, I believe in God. So I was like, how do you know? Like, she wasn't quite sure. So it came out of discussion, well, our parents told us that God created the world, and their parents told them, and their parents told them. But if I ask you, was anybody there when God created the world? Nobody was there. So how do you really know? So the answer is, says Nachmanides, the Ramban at the end of Parshas Bo, he said one time in the history of humankind, he's going to come down, he's going to pull out all the stops, and he's going to say, this is the way to demonstrate that I created the world, because I can start the world right side up, and then I'm going to turn it upside down. And I'm going to take all the laws of nature and flip them back and forth. So the whole point of Yetzias Mitzrayim is to say to us, Chevra, this is the one time in history I'm going to show you all the cards and say I created the world. And not only that, I didn't just wind up the clock and walk away. I'm going to be involved, and therefore the hail is going to come over here, but not over there. And that's why there's a progression through the Makkos. We'll get to that later. But the idea is, the whole point of the Seder is to say, we believe in God, and that God took us out of Egypt, and therefore we have a mission to accomplish in this world. We've got something to do. We've got a charge. So that's kind of the big backdrop of the Haggadah, and that's why, says the Ramban, we have zillions of mitzvahs, millions of mitzvahs that are all Zecher Yetzias Mitzrayim. Most of the mitzvahs that we do are not Zecher L'Briyas HaOlam. Even Shabbos, which is Zecher L'Briyas HaOlam, it's not exclusively Zecher L'Briyas HaOlam, because in Kiddush we also say Zecher Yetzias Mitzrayim, because nobody was there at Briyas HaOlam at their time of creation. So we wear tzitzis and tefillin, and we have Shabbos, and we have tons and tons of mitzvahs that are mezuzah. You walk around. Every time you hit the mezuzah, it's because it's Zecher Yetzias Mitzrayim. So once a year, we have this massive event that we tell everybody that it's going to be Zecher Yetzias Mitzrayim. So
if it would be Matan Torah then, because everybody was actually there, and there were so many people actually witnessing Hashem, as opposed to the hand of Hashem.
So I'm not sure what you mean as witnessing Hashem as opposed to the hand.
You know, at Har Sinai, they heard his voice. They didn't hear his voice at Yetzias Mitzrayim. They saw the miracles that didn't seem to fit into nature.
So I agree with you that there were some specific miracles that took place at Har Sinai in terms of seeing the sound, etc., according to the Medrash. But most of those interpretations of miracles that happened there are not in the text of the Chumash. The purpose of the Makkos, which we'll get to, I guess, later, but we'll mention it now. The purpose of the Makkos was not just as a punitive measure against the Egyptians. It was really like a Shir and Emuna. And that's why sometimes it mentions Vehiflesi. We're going to distinguish, you know, one piece over here, another piece over there. And that's why they constantly refer Etzba Elokimu, because the whole point is just let's get the picture straight. There is a God in the world. It doesn't seem like that all the time, but we're going to get it straight one time. And that's why I make such a tumult about this. So,
The other difference also is that by Yetziat Mitzrayim, it was not exclusively the Jewish nation. By Har Sinai, it was just the Jews that this was happening to. And the point of Yetziat Mitzrayim is that there are witnesses from other nations to say also they saw this thing. They saw these miracles happening and things like that.
I can hear that. That's awesome.
Why it's Yetziat Mitzrayim has like a more elevated status. It wasn't just an exclusive thing where one people could say, oh, look, this happened to us, but no one else saw it.
Good. I like it. It's good. So now that we've understand this, we understand why the rabbis gave us the Haggadah in the first place. How many people have ever gone to the March of the Living or something like that? Okay, I've never gone. I'm a Kohen, so it's largely out of my depth. But if you've gone, some people here have gone. What's that?
I'm too scared to go.
That's right. Some people who have gone will tell you that's been a very powerful experience. So if I were to ask you, Why do you need the March of the Living? We just should teach all the kids to read the history book. What's the whole point in going on the March of the Living? Why do you need that?
It was an experience.
Why is it a reminder more than just reading it in the book?
The vision has sometimes more of an impact than just retelling of the story.
100%. So the experience of it, the vision, seeing it with your own eyes is huge. That makes a major educational impact.
It's
so guess what?
Too. It's being with 6,000 other children, walking, living, breathing Jewish children, walking through Poland, all wearing the same jacket, like on the same day, making a walk that many were not ever able to complete.
100%. So there's
really like a very powerful thing to be able to relive it in that way, do something that was not able to be done.
So I'm sure there are many aspects like that, but I think there's a universal educational aspect that the people who run the March of Living and the Heritage and all these trips, they understand something very basic. And it's been recreated in the Holocaust Museum in Washington to a very nice degree, and also to some degree in the Holocaust Museum here in Illinois, which is also a very fine museum. And that is that there's a fundamental difference in education between experiential learning and book learning. It's just not the same. When you see it, it's a whole different story. So the rabbi said, folks, we have a very important message here. We have an important message that says we believe in God. God chose us with a mission to send this out there to do something in the world. We can't just tell it in a book. And therefore, we're going to have to constantly come up with ways to remind ourselves. And once a year, we're going to reenact the story. And that's really what the Seder is about. It's about experiential learning. So that's why in Sephardicums, now I know you're not Sephardic, you're Yemenite. It's not Sephardic, it's Yemenite.
Not Sephardic.
I know. We got it. So in Sephardic homes, they will actually take matzahs, put it on their shoulder, and run around the table. Because the whole point is to experience it as much as possible. That's the name of the game. So that's why we're doing the Haggadah. So one major component, let's send this back so we got some people just walked in. One major component about this idea of the back and forth in terms of really getting into learning, one of the things that's necessary is the concept of she'ela u'tshuva, asking and answering. We know we begin the Seder with manishtana, so all the kids, everybody learns manishtana, they ask manishtana. What would happen if I was on a desert island, just me and my wife? We had no kids at the Seder, just me and my wife. What would be the halacha? So we would have to ask each other the manishtana. Let's say I was sitting at the Seder all by myself, so I would have to ask myself. So it's kind of a strange concept. Why is that so important? Why is asking and answering such an essential part of the Haggadah? Why does it have to be derech she'ela u'tshuva?
It spurs thought.
Exactly. So this is one of the very important differences between, we mentioned the fact that Yetzias Mitzrayim is so important, we do it all year long. We mention it every time in Kriya Shema. Every time we say Shema, we conclude Asher Yetzias Yitzchem Eretz Mitzrayim. That's called the mitzvah of Zechiras Yetzias Mitzrayim. Remembering, mentioning. But that's not Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim. Sipur is you have to embellish the story, and you got to tell it by questions and answers. Because number one, questions and answers is thought. It's a thought-provoking method. It's also a Socratic method, especially if there are other people at the table. So it encourages other people to get involved in the discussion. It connects with them. The whole notion of She'ela U'tshuva engages other people. It provokes thought. It also increases clarity. Let's say I have an opinion on something, and I'm giving a shiur to the Kollel fellows. So I have a presentation I'm going to make, but then one guy raises his hand and he says, but what about this? You know, I never thought of that. So I need to reconsider to sharpen my position. What am I saying? I'm going to sharpen it up, derech she'elo tshuva, through the back and forth. And that's the study of Talmud. The Talmud, it's like, it can kill you some days because you're investing in a thesis and you're going, then they take question after question. Finally, they throw you on the floor and they say it's out the window. So why do they do that? Because the clarity of the process is what brings it to life. And finally, one more observation that I saw this year from this Haggadah that someone gave me as a gift from Rav Yosef Tzvi Rimon. Rav Yatz has a beautiful idea here. He's a tremendous Talmud Chacham in Har Etzion. He's also the founder of Jab Katif, which is an unusual organization. They were, when the Jews were kicked out of Gush Katif, he was one of the founders of the group of women who started doing the laundry for these people from the hotels, and then they found them jobs and job training. He was really an amazing person. So someone gave me as a gift last night. They dropped off in my house. It was so nice. A two-volume new Haggadah from Rav Yatz two nights ago. And I saw in there, he says, you know what? Sometimes you get comfortable, too comfortable with ideas. If you don't challenge yourself, if you don't ask questions, so you're going to lose the edge a little bit. Maybe there are some approaches that we've had, some ideas. We've had them for a long time, but just because we've thought them all this time doesn't necessarily mean that they're correct. And we always have to be willing to ask questions. Part of being Jewish is asking questions and challenging the status quo. Part of the whole nature of the Seder is challenging the status quo of Avdus, of rebelling against a society that's pagan or that's cruel or that's self-centered or self-absorbed and narcissistic. We're going to rebel against that. We're going to constantly challenge ourselves and the society around us. We're going to constantly challenge with questions, asking the question, is this the right way to go? So Derech She'ela U'Tshuva is a major component of this. Someone mentioned before, I saw this from the chief rabbi, Sir Lord Jonathan Sacks Shlita. He has in his Haggadah a great diuk. I mentioned it the other day to someone. The word Haggadah comes from the pasuk of Vihigadata Labincha. We tell our kids. But it could have said V'amarta Labincha. Or V'dibarta Labincha. Or V'siparta Labincha. But it doesn't say that. I'm now on my second little bullet point because I did the third bullet point first because I'm a little bit out of order. He says that the word Haggadah comes from the word Gid. What is a Gid? Anybody know what a Gid is? It's a sinew, and I think
Gid
it's
hanashe.
A... What's that?
Gid hanashe.
Yes, a sinew. It's a Gid hanashe is a sinew that goes in the leg, but I think it's a tendon. I think it's a tendon or a ligament. I don't know. You have to ask people who know anything about science. It's something in your body that connects the bones to the muscles. Right? That's something in your body. What's it called?
Tendon.
Tendon. There you have it. So a Gid is a tendon. So lahagid is not just to tell, it's to connect. So v'higadata labincha, says Rabbi Sacks, is you got to be able to connect with the kids. And that's part of the reason that she'elo tshuva is so important. As I know from working with students on a regular basis, so if you don't engage them, if they're not active learners, kiss them goodbye. They are gone. You got to have active learners. You got to be active in the process. So if you want to connect with the kids, you got to reach them where they are. So therefore, v'higadata labincha means you have to do things that are going to interest the kids. So that's why you got to give out weird things or do weird things. Anything that you can do. These are like all the rabbis were so incredibly brilliant in their educational methodology. All the stunts that they pulled out, this is like very ahead of its time in terms of educational philosophy. Understanding that you need motivation, so you need incentives for the kids to stay up. But you need to engage them both in the questions and the answers and in terms of weird things that are going to catch their attention. So don't get boring at the Seder. You got to be interesting. You got to connect with them. And through that, you're going to connect generations. Because that's the whole backbone of the Seder, which is this idea that it's not just us today, the first people are sitting at the Seder. Before us and before them and before them, the whole notion of Mesorah, of tradition, that I'm doing this because my parents did this, because their parents and grandparents and great, all the way back. And that's the way it's going to be tomorrow. So someone pointed out, it's a beautiful insight in terms of the nature of teaching our children and engaging our children. Because the pasuk says that when they were in Mitzrayim, Hashem says to them, I'm going to take you folks out. Laman tesaper ba'oznei bincha uben bincha. Eis asher esalalti b'mitzrayim. So you could tell your children and your grandchildren. Well, is there a mitzvah at the Seder of teaching our grandchildren? Doesn't mention anything of the Seder teaching our grandchildren. So I saw somewhere such a tremendous shot. They pointed out, just don't remember where it is that v'higadata labincha, that's going to be the indicator for ben bincha. If we can connect with our children, if we can share this message in a powerful way with our kids, well, that's how it's going to go to our grandchildren. That's the measure of success. You can't skip a generation. It doesn't work like that. We have to work within our circle of influence and look at our children. What do we invest in educating our children, especially the night of the Seder? That's our prime time education slot. It's not about anything else except educating the kids of these fundamentals of Judaism, of the Yiddishkeit that we know and love. We got to give it to our kids because if we give it to them the right way, hopefully, you know, to a large degree, we did our job and they're going to give it to their kids. So the v'higadata labincha is this idea of connecting all the way back and all the way forward. The Seder is this incredible timeless experience, and that's part of the reason, perhaps, that Talmud Torah is a part of the Seder. We're going to get to it later. It's on your paper. It's section C. We'll get to it in a little bit. The section of Tzei Ulamad, which I always thought was the most boring part of the Seder. It's the rabbinic exegesis. It's the back and forth of learning out from the stories. We'll get to it in a little bit. But what is that all about? It's the same concept of timelessness. It's amazing. I'm looking at the same verses that the rabbis did 1,500 years ago. And I'm having the same conversations with my children that they did with theirs, that Amir Tz Hashem, our future kids, will have with their kids. Because it comes back to the same Torah. And we got that Torah, yes. Why did we get out of Mitzrayim? We got out of Mitzrayim with a telos, a destination of getting to Har Sinai, but this is the starting point. So this is something that's going to go on. It connects us from the past to the future. I forget who said it. They pointed out that if you are a people that has no history, you will have no future. But Jews are acutely aware of both our history and our future. And there's kind of this time continuum, and we're just part of it. And that's what Torah is about, and that's what the Haggadah is about. Yeah. The transcendence over time.
Transcendence,
exactly. I like what Rabbi Sachs said. Okay, it probably was there. Okay, let's move on. So we spoke about Haggadah, we got our questions and answers. Manishtana. Now, let's go to the top where I put a little section A. We asked our questions, why is this night different than the other night? And we answered. The answer to the question is, guess what? We were nobodies, and God took us out of Mitzrayim. God, He showed us who He is, and He gave us a mission. We've got something to accomplish in this world. So, we say, Avadim Hayinu, that's little section A. Now, I want to make one note in this paragraph that really struck me this year. Avadim Hayinu Lefaro B'Mitzrayim. Pop quiz. I tried this on the students today. Avadim Hayinu Lefaro B'Mitzrayim. We were Avadim. What does that mean? Okay, slaves. And then what did God do? He took us out. Vayotzi'enu Hashem Elokeinu Misham, biyad chazaka, with a strong hand, of Izra'nu Tuya. Now, somebody want to read the next 10 words for me. What would have happened had we not gotten out? You won't get called on even if you have children in the academy. What's that? Okay. What would we still be? V'ilu lo'atzo...
Slaves.
What's that?
Enslaved.
Bingo. Enslaved. It does not say slaves. It doesn't say Hayinu Avadim. It says Hayinu Mishuabadim. Subtle but important difference. What's the difference? What's the difference between Avadim and Mishubadim? Bingo. So that's one piece of it. Let's say we were to run out of Mitzrayim in the middle of the night. We'd still have the same slave mentality. We would always be looking over our shoulder. Maybe they're behind us. Maybe they're going to catch us. Maybe they're going to get us. So maybe we wouldn't be Avadim, but we would still be Mishubadim. Maybe further. Let's say Paro would have let us out. What would have happened then? We would still feel an indebtedness to Paro for letting us out. So it would be Mishubad. Mishubad is a halachic term for indebtedness to someone. If let's say I owe you $1 million, so I'm Mishubad to you for the $1 million. So every time I see you, I'm like, oh, Taka, Dr. Kesar, I owe her $1 million. So I have a certain, you know, mindset. So Ilo HaKotzi HaKadosh Baruch Hu, had God not taken us out and totally freed us with no cheshbonos, we would feel enslaved. We would feel indebted. But one more level from Dr. Twersky from Pittsburgh, the great psychiatrist. He has a tremendous essay you can find on TorahWeb.org, one of the websites where he disseminates some of his Torah alongside many of the Rosh Yeshiva from YU. He says, you want to know what Avdus is? He says, I'll tell you what Avdus is. He had a kid who came to his clinic, and this kid was seriously addicted to drugs and a few other things. So the kid turned his life around, he went to his Seder, and he tells Dr. Tversky how at the Seder, the father said the words, Avadim Hayinu Lefaro B'Mitzrayim. And the kid says to the father, he says, no, you don't understand. You don't know what Avadim is. You don't know what it means to be a slave. He says, I can tell you what it means to be a slave. Someone who has an addiction, he says, is the only person who can tell you what that means. He says, because you truly have no control. So Mishubadim, maybe we wouldn't have been physically slaves, but had God not given us a set of values, of directions, of guidelines, how to live a meaningful life, and given us self-control, the determination to say, we are going to choose what we're going to accomplish. You can do whatever you want. You can be an addict sleeping on the street corner, but that's not the world that's given to us on a flat playing field. Then we would still be Mishubadim. We would be constantly looking around and saying, well, what is society telling us to do? What are the values that are out there at any given time? Well, if you're living in China in the 60s, so it says, okay, kill babies if you have too many of them. And if you're living in some other country, so they tell you some other values. And these just come and go and they shift in the wind. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu says to us, look, don't be a slave to anybody else except to God. Now, what does that mean? It means, truly, Rav Kook has this incredible insight. What is a truly free person? What does it mean? What do you think is a free person? How would you determine freedom? Bechira chafshis, free will, okay? The free will to do what? To do good or bad? Rav Kook has a very profound analysis of what you just said, which is he says that freedom is the ability to be yourself. That's a really profound statement.
But it's funny because the opposite is almost true too. Like when you first read it, I was thinking that in the modern world, if you can really appreciate that God gave you everything you have, and that it's not, you know, it's you know, what he wants for you, then you're not enslaved to, you know, this materialistic society of like work, work, work. So, you know, it's sort of like by deciding that you have no control, that's actually what I find liberating.
Interesting.
You know?
Okay, so I would say that's what they would call the willingness of, almost like a literary concept of willing, the suspension of willingness of disbelief sort of thing. That you're putting your will in that basket. So 100%, but that volitional choice that you have to say, I'm going to lead my life in this way, who gave you the guidelines to do that? That's exactly coming from God. And that's what I think Rav Kook is getting at in the following very interesting analogy. What's the difference between a piece of paper with ink on it and a tablet that was engraved? What's the difference between those two?
Ink can wash off.
Okay, the ink can wash off. And more fundamentally, the ink is a separate substance, separate and apart. Case in point, the fact that it can wash off. So there's a Mishnah in Pirkei Avos that says, "Ein lecha ben chorin, ela misha lomei Torah." Who's a free person? Somebody who is involved in Torah. Why? Because it says about the luchos, "Al tikre chorus," engraved. Rather, you should say chorus, freedom. So it's a rabbinic play on words, right? The rabbi sitting around telling jokes. Freedom and engraved, chorus and chorus. So Rav Kook says, "No, you're not getting it." He says, the idea of the Torah being engraved on our souls, it means that deep down, everybody has a spark of God in them. Everybody wants to do the right thing in the world. And to be free is to have no shackles and no fetters, to let yourself do what deep down in your soul you know is the right thing. Therefore, the Torah is not written on our hearts. It's engraved. It's not a foreign idea that we have to somehow assimilate into our being. In ourselves, deep, deep down, the Rambam has this all the time, deep down we want to do the right thing. And God, by giving us the framework to be a part of, enables us to be ourselves. It's like a mashal. I want to be an artist. I want to be an artist, but you know what? I go to graduate school and everybody says, oh, do not be an artist. That's like the worst thing. You know what you need to be? You need to be an accountant. Accountant. Okay. So I kill myself and I become an accountant. So what am I going to be? An accountant, but I'm not going to be very happy because deep down I really want to be an artist. God says deep down, he gave us a soul. Everybody has this spiritual yearning, and that's why so many people are all in the world looking for spirituality. He says, look, I'm going to give you freedom. The freedom is the ability to have a life that enables you to really be true to yourself. To be true to yourself, to your soul, to the deep down, to the person that you really want to be. And that's why we're not Meshubadim anymore. We can turn off all of the influences of society. And we can say, wait a second, we're going to decide, what is it really for me? What do I want out of this world? I'm going to cut and paste. Well, I see something that's good, I'm going to bring it home. But if I see something that's not welcome, I'm going to say, you know what? I have the freedom to say, that's not going to be in my house. That's not going to be in my life. We're not slaves to the outside world because we've been given the Torah. Yeah.
And getting back to what we were just reading, I just want to make sure I also understand what you're saying, that had Paro freely and willingly let us go, we would feel that debt to him after we left.
That's part of it. A, we would feel a debt to him.
And that by Hashem hardening his heart and us seeing it, we know who we really are indebted to.
That's number one. And number two, he actually took us out.
Mm-hmm.
But there's another, this is, now I'm going far afield. The president of Yeshiva University, Richard Joel, has a great distinction, a great line. He talks about the difference between freedom from and freedom to. If Paro let us out, we'd be freed from something, but But Rav Aaron Soloveitchik also, in an essay in the Logic of the Heart, Logic of the Mind, has a similar idea about Pesach. Okay, we'd be a bunch of wild hooligans looking for something. Not only that, very often when you have freedom from, it's associated with a phenomenon known as violence. And we've seen that quite a bit in the last couple of months. It's not ancient history. When you have a rebellion, you have a revolution, so there's a sense of anarchy. There's wildness. But when we left Mitzrayim, it wasn't freedom from, and now everybody's like, okay, what do we do now? How do we build coalitions and put together a meaningful civilization? That's not what happened. We left in an orderly manner. Could you imagine a revolution in orderly manner? Not one shot fired. Not one person killed. Not one person trampled. We left l'shivteim. Obviously, there's a lot of anxiety because these people were slaves. But it wasn't, says Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, HaKadosh Baruch Hu orchestrated the Exodus so that we had a law, we had order, everybody stayed in their homes, they ate their meal as their family, then they packed themselves up. Could you imagine? A few million Jewish people, they packed themselves and they left. Yeah.
You had Machabekhura.
Yes.
So, although man wasn't doing any of the killing, there was some violence. And I think it's, you know, as you're saying this, what you're saying makes a lot of sense, but I don't think it's so much if like, if Pharaoh let us out, and we were supposed to do something, we would have said that Hashem was behind that.
For sure. If we would have...
It's really about the two, not about the how. And Pharaoh went beyond what he was supposed to do, which is why he was punished in the way... Like, he had a job and he overdid it, or so...
I'm combining here two different ideas. Let's parse these two ideas. Idea number one is, had Pharaoh not let us out, we would have been indebted to him. But this is really a separate second idea, but I just couldn't help but put it in here because I like this idea. And that is that, yes, even if power had let us out, but the notion that God said, I have a destination for you people, the reason you're leaving here is not to be wandering bandits in the desert. The reason you're leaving here is you have something to build and to create. You know, you look at the Russian Revolution, how many people were killed? All these kind of things where the people who were oppressed, they took out their aggression. Whereas in this case, we had a clear destination. We're going to Har Sinai, we've got a Torah to get. And ultimately, Terence is
ultimate.
Yeah, that was a nod. That was a nod or no?
Sorry.
This is not an art auction. That would cost you like 30. I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. That's why I always tell the students, because you never know. You get like the, I'm doing this. Sometimes like, is that a hand? No, no. I once had a class with Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik, who is Joseph B. Soloveitchik's son. So he's a professor. I forget now exactly where he was. That was like the most intimidating class I ever had. It was one of the most rewarding classes I ever had. But whenever he would ask people to read, we would have a very good practice. We would do this. No eye contact. Never make eye contact and you're safe. That was the general rule, except if you weren't prepared. There was one time he kicked us all out. He came, it was a class introduction. We showed him, he wanted to know, I still remember, he wanted to know who was the smog. And he asked one, two, three. By the time he got to the fourth person, he picked up his teacup. He looked at us. He said, if you're not prepared, I will not teach. And he was out of there. It was a very intense life experience. Anyway, I digress. So the point of the Seder is to tell this story, and we're going to tell it from the beginning to the end. That's why the rabbis of the Talmud say you have to have maschil beginus. You got to tell it from the bad, umesayim b'shevach. You got to end on the positive note. So that's what we do in section A. Avodim hayinu l'faro b'mitzrayim, vayotzienu. We were slaves, and then he took us out. Maschil beginus, umesayim b'shevach. But you notice, if you look at section B, we do the same thing again. We say, mitchila, at the beginning, ov de avodazara hayu avosenu. We were idol worshippers to all kinds of pagan deities. And then, va'achshav kervanu hamokom lavodaso. And then God brought us close to his service. That's section B. All right, my handwriting is not the greatest, but that is a B. So which is it? Is it A or is it B? The answer is? It's both. Because the Talmud has a debate. Rav and Shmuel. Is it maschil b'genus u'masayim b'shevach avodam hayinu v'yotzienu? That's one way of looking at it. Start with the bad and with the good. The other way of looking at it is we started out as idol worshippers and we ended up as monotheists, servants of God. So the answer is we paskin, we rule that it's both. We put both in there. And that's why it's bracketed here and here. Now in the interim, we amplify the story because we, like, we'll say in a little bit, the purpose of the Haggadah is not just to tell the story in 5 minutes and go to sleep. We have to really get into how important this story is and how it's going to affect even the great rabbis and even the small children and the Tom and the Rosh and all the different kids. But we're going to say it twice because we're going to look at it from both vantages point, from both vantage points. But my question is, let's step back. Why did the rabbis say you have to be maslo beginus? Why do you have to start with the bed? I have to start with the bed. Say, just say, God took us out of Mitzrayim. Start from stage 10. Why do you have to go back to stage 1?
Start with your roots.
Why is that important? Especially in this context when the roots are bad. They're negative. We even go back to Terach. Unsavory character.
To appreciate what you have.
That's, I think, the key here. Because you cannot get the full perspective unless you see the whole picture. It's like any notion of gratitude. Any notion of gratitude, it's always going to be commensurate with the level of perspective. So let's say, I don't know, you come to my house for Shabbos lunch. So you see the cholent. Let's focus on the cholent because that's my job. The cholent. How was the cholent? It was very delicious. So you thank me for the cholent. Very good. But if I told you that I made that cholent at 3 o'clock in the morning, which is very rare, that's really not usual. But let's say I made the cholent at 1 o'clock in the morning, after I had finished, you know, doing who knows what. So you'd be like, wow, you really feel indebted. I bothered to make the cholent at 1 o'clock in the morning. And what if I told you that, I don't know, there was some crazy crisis that was going on. I was coming back from South Africa in the baggage claim. I don't know, spent 3 hours in the baggage claim waiting for my bag. I come back, it's 5 o'clock in the morning, and now you have cholent. Then you really feel indebted, right? You would really feel a sense of hakaras hatov. But if all I say to you is, and I'm not asking you, if you come to my home for a Shabbos meal, I'm not asking that you do like a whole investigation of how long it took me to make the cholent. I'm just pointing out that if we recognize the investment that somebody else makes, the whole notion of gratitude takes a whole other dimension. That's, I think, the reason why you got to have the maskel beginus m'sayim b'shevach. You got to have the whole perspective. You got to see the tumunah maleah. You got to see the whole picture. So that's the big chunk of the Haggadah that we start with is Avadim Hayinu, and then Mitchila Ovdei Avodah Zarah Hayu Avoseinu. So let's just look at what we do here. On section with the top half of the Haggadah, so we started out with our questions. We gave the answer. Why do we do all these crazy things? And we say, you know why? Because we believe in God. God took us out of Mitzrayim and He gave us a mission. So we tell the story of how the great rabbis, it doesn't matter how old you are, it doesn't matter how much you know, you always have to ask because you have to add a level of understanding, you have to add the engagement. And we have to say it during the day and during the night, and then we have to relate it to all kinds of people. So that's taken us from Avadim Hayinu to Mitchila of the Avodah Zarah. And then we say the same thing. We started out spiritually bereft, and now we are enriched. So we had bad to good on a physical level, bad to good on a spiritual level. So we keep saying how it's important to tell the story in its fullness. Well, how are we going to tell the story in the fullness? So we have a new idea. It's called, in English, exegesis. That means I take a text and I read between the lines. Because the rabbis of the Talmud, the rabbis of our tradition, have always understood that there are two aspects to Torah. There's a written Torah. I can give you it in a book. You can take it home and read it yourself. But there's a whole other dimension to Torah called Torah Shebal Peh, the oral Torah, the tradition that's passed from generation to generation. Now that oral tradition, that it's not so easy just to put down in a book. Number one, because it develops over time. The levels of interpretation continuously grow. But especially in the times of the Talmud, the rabbis didn't have all the levels of interpretation down pat. They actually were given tools by Moshe at Sinai, and they used those tools to interpret what is going on between the lines. So there is what it says, and then there's what's written in between the lines. How do you know what these tools are? So some of you are familiar. If you get to Shacharis very early, in time for Karbonos, I'm not looking at anyone, but sometimes we get there in time for Karbonos. There's a concluding paragraph, or maybe you remember this from many years ago, Rabbi Shmuel Omer B'Shlosh Esrei Midos. That's where they say the first Kaddish in the morning. That passage, that brisa of Rabbi Shmuel, lists several of the rabbinic tools. That's what it is. It has nothing to do with Karbonos. The rabbis put it there because it's a section of Talmud Torah. We don't want you to start your day without any learning. So if we get there early enough to say Karbonos and to say Rabbi Yishmael, which I'm not going to tell you whether I have said Rabbi Yishmael in the last 6 months or not, but the concept is there. We should have that Torah learning, and we tell you there's something called a Binyan Av, where the rabbis look at one model and then they see another and they draw a comparison. All kinds of tools. So the rabbis, they look at the Torah text and they say, wow, we're going to look at it on one level and then we're going to look at it again. And we're going to keep looking at it in between the lines using different tools that we have in our toolbox to analyze it. So that's called medrash. That's drash. That's rabbinic interpretation. Sometimes it's halachic, sometimes it's homiletic, but that gives us a clue into what God is trying to teach us beyond the surface level of what's going on here. So we're going to do the same thing at the Seder. Now, I never understood this growing up, so I was always like, this is just one boring litany of words. It didn't make any sense to me. But now that I'm a little bit older, so now I understand what we're doing and why we're doing it. Because the whole point is to embellish the story, to really get to the guts of what Hashem did for us and what it means for us, how bad it was and how incredible it was. So we do that just as the rabbis did it. The rabbis looked at verses in the Torah and they read between the lines. So here's how you do it. If you were a Talmudic sage living 1,800 years ago, so put on your thinking cap and look at section C. You take a verse. Arami ovid ovi vayered mitzrayma. Vayogar sham bimseim ot vayisham legoi gadol atzum varav. That is a verse. One verse, end of the story. So what do the rabbis do? Look at the next five lines. They take each little bite and they explain it. Vayered Mitzrayim. Why does it say Vayered Mitzrayim in that phraseology that they went down? Says the Medrash, Anos al pi adibur. We were coerced by Hashem to go down there. Vayogar Sham. Why is it Vayogar? He just dwelled there. It doesn't say he lived there. Vayichisham. Because it's supposed to imply it was supposed to be temporary. Bimsei Ma'at. With a few numbers. How many? What does it say? 70. So you see what's going on here is that the rabbis are looking at every word with a microscope and saying, what does every word mean? And using that as the platform for getting the story. So why are we doing this? So one level, says Rav Soloveitchik, is because the whole notion of Vihigata Talabincha telling our kids has to do with the transmission of the oral Torah. It's so important that we teach our kids Torah, they teach the community and the next generation Torah, but it's not enough to hand them a book. It's to tell them that this is a living Torah. It's not just something you can write down. It's, I want to tell you guys that the rabbis have given us something and we're going to give it to you and you're going to give it to your kids. This is Medrash. This is a classic rabbinic interpretation. So we're going to do the same thing that they've done for generations and generations and look for meaning in the Torah and pass it on. It's something that you can't find in a book. Now we find in a book because our memory is a little bit not as sharp as it used to be. But the idea is that Torah Sheba'al Peh, it's handed over from person to person, not in a book. That's one. Okay? But number two, if I were to ask you, all right, rabbis, come up with a few verses that you're going to analyze to discuss Yetzias Mitzrayim, the Exodus. What book would you open? Which of the five books of the Chumash? Shmos, right? You would agree. What's that? What's that? Which one?
No, I guess that.
I would have guessed we take Shemos, right? There's like endless psukim that talk about the Exodus and Shemos, but guess what? We don't do that. We pick Aramid Oved Avi. Anybody know where that's from? It's from the end of Sefer Devarim. At the beginning of Parshas Kisavo, it is a declaration. It's a declaration called Mikra Bikurim. Mikra Bikurim. What is Mikra Bikurim? Anybody know what Mikra Bikurim is? Yes. Exactly. It's the declaration when the farmer brings his first fruits to the Beis HaMikdash. Isn't that interesting? Why, of all things, would we choose Mikra Bikurim to be the verses that analyze the story of the Exodus, if we could have had any other ones? Any suggestions? Beautiful. So it's a model of remembering.
It's basically the same model.
Same model, I think, in two very specific ways. One is, we spoke about before, gratitude. The feeling of gratitude from this farmer, I can't even imagine what that would be like. You know, today, many of us, we get paychecks that are e-delivered right into the bank account. You don't even see the check anymore. If you were a farmer 2,000 years ago, you would take, in the wintertime, the few kernels that you had in a bag, that were there that could be bread to feed your family. You're going to take them out to the backyard, throw them in the ground, and look at the heavens and say, please God, make it rain. You would wait months until you would have to sweat like a dog under the sun every day working that field until you could bring it in. Finally, you bring in the first fruits. Imagine the sense of accomplishment and the sense of gratitude. So you come to the base of Mikdash and you say, wow, this is unbelievable. Thank you, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, for what I get. So now we're sitting at the Seder, so the rabbis were like, okay, if you want to capture the feeling, if you want to tell your kids what this feels like, tell them this story. Tell them of someone who works so hard and has such an intense feeling of emotion and gratitude. That's what it's supposed to feel like at the Seder. Now, do we reach that level? Maybe once in a lifetime, but it's something to strive for. So number one, there's this element of Hakara Satov. Number two, there's the totality of the story that's in a very short space. The guy starts with Arami Dovidov, he gives you the whole span of Jewish history on one foot. Number three, I think the fact that it's said in first person is a very powerful tool here. Because you could have picked a pasuk in Parsha Shmos, but you didn't, because that would have been a narrative. Tonight, it's not about a narration. Tonight, it's about me, every man, woman, and child speaking, telling the story for ourselves. So just like the farmer came to the base of Mikdash and he told his or her story, so we too, we're going to sit down in the Seder, we're going to tell our story. And that's exactly what's going on in these verses, and we're going to parse them just like the rabbis did. So that was section C. If you go down to the next page on the bottom, where you have section D, it's the same thing. You have the pasuk of Vayotzienu, so whereby the first section was how bad it was. But let's say in section C, for example, Vayanunu, they afflicted us. Vayinu olenu avoda kasha, all the different befarech with back-breaking labor. And then it says, Vayaris and Yenu, Zu Precious Derech Eretz, the fact that they broke down the family structure. You know, part of this idea of embellishing is really understanding how bad it was. I guess the only analogy that I could conceive is from the labor camps, where you had Vayaris and Yenu, Zu Precious Derech Eretz. Men and women couldn't see each other. So the families were decimated. So the Medrash says how the women had to sneak out to the fields where the husbands were working to find them. The whole point of this medrash is to open up the story, to read the story, whether it's in English or some way that looking at how hard it was, we transition into Vayotzienu, how amazing it was that God took us out and all the incredible things that He did. So if we're going from the third column in page 1 to the first column in page 2, now we have a full explanation of Vayotzienu. So we say, B'yor chazaka zuader, if He ripped them with dever, and Zeron and Tuya zuacherev, He slay them with a sword, moragonal. And then, as is a good rabbinic interpretation, you have more than one option. He can't just have one opinion from the rabbis. The rabbis, the general rule is, if you have a question, is what is the law in this particular case? So the answer is, it's a machlokas, two different opinions. So that's exactly what we have in the Seder. I gave you this little underline where it says, Dovar Acher, in the underline on the first column, in section 2, right there, and the arrow. What that means is, you just took the words of that top pasuk. The verse was, Vayotzienu Hashem in Mitzrayim, B'yor Chazakov, Zeron Atuyim, Mora Godol, Uva Ososu Mosim. And we parse them in the first section to say it means pestilence and death and Gilui Shechina. But now we see something else. Dover Acher means let's go back to that verse and get another level of interpretation. Another take home. Biyar Chazaka, that means two. Uvizroa Natuya, also two words. Uva Moragadol, another two words. Uva Osos, Otot is in plural. So another two words. Uva Moftim, another two words. So that phrase of how awesome it was that God took us out, if you build all those word plays together, what do you get? What number? 10. Say the rabbis, you look at this, it reminds you of the 10 Makos. It's a pretty awesome trick. They said, if you look at the Chumash long enough, you will come up with amazing insight. So that's exactly what the rabbis did. They looked at this verse. I don't know how many people, it could be that what I'm saying right now to you is completely obvious. You knew this since you were 6 years old. But it certainly was not obvious to me. And when you put it all on one piece of paper and you line it up, it makes so much more sense of what is going on. We're trying to take these verses that are from our Torah and amplify them with these different layers of meaning. So you have one track. Track one that starts Vayotzienu right under my bracket there that goes down until Dover Acher. Then we go back again. We say, Dover Acher, you know what? I'm going to look at the same verse and come up with another level of interpretation. And that's going to be our segue to the 10 plagues. Okay, we are way crazy, ridiculously behind on time. So we're going to take a pause for 10 seconds of questions, comments, and observation, and then should we keep going? All right. I haven't thrown anything yet. Questions, comments, or observations on this yet? Yes?
When you were asking why we start from the bad to the good, I was thinking like Hanukkah, Ma'amu, the Kodesh.
Yeah, it's a process, absolutely. Mm-hmm. That's why Beis Hillel, we rule you go from the top to the bottom. Any other questions, comments, or observations? Okay, let's keep going. We still have a few more. We alluded to it before, the Esser Makos. One aspect of Esser Makos is certainly to mete out the appropriate punishment to the Egyptians. But another is this idea of emuna, of instilling within us that sense of that God exists, that He runs the world, and that He is involved, and ultimately that He chose the Jewish people. And that's how we break down, perhaps, the Makos. There's a lot more to say about this, but Rabbi Yehuda's mnemonic of Tetzach Hadash Ba'achav is not just a child's game. It's actually the stages of the development of the Makos. The first one is, you know, we got to tell power, Ani Hashem, I am God. So once Kinim came around, they said, oh, Etzba Elokim Hi. We thought it was magic, now we see, you know what? We've got it. It's God. And then Arov comes along and he starts getting involved in the world, saying this neighborhood is going to be like this and that neighborhood is going to be like that. And finally, the last Makkah, we get to Bechoros. Makkah's Bechoros, God chooses us. And that's the end of the story. The end of the story is to say, B'ni Bechori Yisrael. We are like the firstborn among all the nations. So the other nations, they're also B'Tselem Elokim, but as the firstborn, I am a firstborn, so I have a big responsibility. I have to tell everybody else in my family what the story is. I have to inspire them with all the lessons that I've learned. That's the role of the Bechor. If he doesn't do a good job of it, so somebody else is going to get that role. You know, it's not just because you're the firstborn doesn't mean you're going to get that job. Ephraim and Menashe, maybe it didn't work out like they thought it was going to work out. The point is, you got to stay mission-driven. You got to stay focused on the mission of what it means to be the Bechor. It means to take the message and share it with other people. So that's the end game of Makkah's Bechoros that says God chose us. And that's the literally putting the blood on the doorstep and God's stepping over. That's the message of Emuna that we're trying to convey. We conclude this section as we continue to embellish how great it was, what all the things that God did for us, how many Makos were there. So now, three different rabbinic interpretations from the Mishnah period, Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Elazar, and Rabbi Akiva, all of how many Makos there were. Again, started with Genus, how bad it was in column 3, ending at column 1, how amazing it was, and then we sing Dayenu, we say, Kama Malos Tovos Lamakom Aleinu, how much gratitude we have, and we go from the beginning to the end. And we could say all kinds of Divrei Torah about the stages of Dayenu, but I think the main point not to be lost is the notion of gratitude and God's providential hand in guiding us out of the Seder. So now that we've finished this whole section, we've gotten to the Beis HaMikdash, that's the point of Geula. We say in the shul, in most shuls in our neighborhood, on Shabbos, when we say the Mishaberach for Medinat Yisrael, we say it's Reishis Tzmichas Geula Seinu. So why is it Reishis Tzmichas Geula Seinu? How do we know that it's not Geula yet? Well, my Rebbe, Harav Herschel Schefter Shalita, has a very long essay where he points out that the reason why, al pi halacha, we consider the state of Israel as Reishis Tzmichas Geulaseinu, because it's a step in the process of the building of the Beis HaMikdash. We're not going to be satisfied, we're not going to have Geula, it's not going to be a perfect world until we have the Beis HaMikdash. How long is it going to take? We don't know. We hope it's going to be tomorrow, but we're going to just keep building one step at a time, one good deed at a time, one day the Ribbono Shel Olam will answer our prayers. We keep hoping for it. But Geula means the building of the Beis HaMikdash, and that's why it concludes, Bona Lono Es Beis HaBechira. The end of the Dayenus are, God built us the Beis HaMikdash, and that's why we say it's Reishis Tzmichas Geulaseinu, because we believe that the state of Israel is one step closer to the building of the Beis HaMikdash. It's an incredible Targum Yonasan Ben Uziel, who says that, believe it or not, at the night of the Seder, the Jews were taken to Yerushalayim, to Har HaMoriah. Now, I don't know what that means. He says it on the Pasuk, V'yasod Eschem Al Ke'afin Yesharim, I carried you on the wings of eagles. I carried you that night to the Beis HaMikdash. So what he means by that, I'm not 100% sure. If he means that was geographic, literal, or just figurative. But why he's saying that is because he wants to say to us, that night we tasted Geula. And Geula is Beis HaMikdash. Beis HaMikdash is a time when we say, look, God has a house in this world. It means that the whole world is perfect. Everybody is God-centric. Everyone's getting the message. And we're all doing what we're supposed to be doing and focusing on creating a divine world. So that's why the ultimate end goal of what we're trying to accomplish is the Beis HaMikdash. Because the Beis HaMikdash, that gives us the focus. That gives us the direction. We talked about it before in terms of having a life of freedom, of knowing what we're supposed to do, right from wrong. The clarity, the Beis HaMikdash is a place of clarity. Today, do we have so much clarity? We don't have a lot of clarity. A lot of confusion today. In Beis HaMikdash time, there was a prophet, at least in the initial Beis HaMikdash time when things were good, that was the level of clarity. We move on now. It's not enough just to tell the story. Because then Rabbi Gamliel says, wait a second, we got to say three different things. We got to say three things. Pesach, Matzah, Umarah. And if you don't say Pesach, Matzah, and Marar, you're not Yotze. You didn't fulfill your obligation of? Of what? What didn't you fulfill? One opinion of the Rishonim is retelling the story. The other opinion of the Rishonim is but what is necessary in terms of the saying of Pesach Matzah Marah? What do we gain when we say that? What mitzvah did we get? Some of the Rishonim say, you know what? The actual mitzvah of Pesach is lacking if you don't say the reason. The actual mitzvah of matzah and maror is not the same. The simple pshat is like you said, I think that's the basic pshat of most Rishonim. That what, if you don't say Pesach, matzah, and maror, you're not describing the events. You're missing a lot of the pieces of the puzzle here. But the other pshat of Rishonim is no, realize how central speech and the telling of the story is. It's like, imagine, could you imagine? I sat down and I took my lulav and esrog, and the rabbi said, no, you wouldn't fulfill your mitzvah of lulav and esrog because you didn't tell the story. Well, that's not the halacha in lulav esrog. It's only halacha here because of the centrality of telling the story. It also has to do with the role of speech at the Seder, which we certainly do not have time for tonight. Maybe another time. One line on each Pesach, Matzah, and Marar. Pesach. Rav Kook has a beautiful line. I have no idea what this is, but I heard it in his name. What does the word Pesach mean? What does it mean?
Passover.
That's what I always thought. Rav Kook says, no, it's not. He says, no, it's not. How do I know it's not? Or it is? Well, he doesn't say no, it's not. But I'm saying, no, it's not. Elio Hanavi, he stood on Har HaCarmel and he looked at the Jews and he says, folks, we have a problem here. You guys are worshiping God and you're worshiping the Baal. And he says to them, Ad Masai Atem Poschim Al Shnei HaSeipim. How long will you hold on to both ends? He says, choose, make a decision. If Hashem is your God, luchu acharav. If the Baal is your God, gizut to hate. Gaivek, no problem. Ar matay asem poschim ashnei sifim, says Rav Kook something unbelievable. Asher pasach abote avosinim mitzrayim, Rav Kook's interpretation is not that God skipped over our homes, but he held on to our homes. Miloshon poseach al shnei ha-se'ifim. What ennobled us that night was the experience of Gilui Shechina, was the experience of encountering the Almighty on a first name basis, so to speak. He was right there. Lo ayde malach, lo ayde shleach, no confusion. Moshe Rabbeinu stayed out of the way. It was only HaKadosh Baruch Hu. What ennobled us that night was the actual hand of Hashem. The word Pesach, says Rav Kook, cannot just mean Passover, it actually means hold on to. That's one piece. Another, matzah. Says the Avudraham, if you count up the number of brachos we're making, believe it or not, we're making 7 brachos on our matzah. 7 brachos we're making at the night of the Seder. 7 brachos. When else do we make 7 brachos? Sheva brachos. You know what we read the night of the Seder? We read, what? Shir HaShirim, the Song of the Beloved. And then we count 7 cycles of 7 days, 7 cycles of 7, and then we stand under a mountain, think, wait a minute. I think we have a parallel here. I think we have a wedding theme, don't we? When you get to Har Sinai, we stand under the chuppah. Kaf Aleihem Har Kegiges can also have the connotation, God put the mountain over our heads like a chuppah. So to speak, when we left Mitzrayim, this was the beginning of our relationship with God. What do we eat at the Seder? We eat matzah. It's a very profound lesson here that goes back all the way back to the Chet of Adam HaRishon. Very profound lesson. You want to have a relationship with God? It's just like having a relationship with anybody else. If I have a relationship with my spouse and it's all about me, that relationship is going to go real south real fast. What's the key to a good relationship? Trying to figure out what is in it for the other person. I got to put myself in check so that I can make space for somebody else. We get into this relationship with our Kodesh Baruch Hu, with God, and we say, you know what? We recognize that we are going to be benefited by making ourselves smaller to make room for you. Just like anybody in any relationship makes themselves smaller so that they can make room for the other person. You know what, God? You squeeze the toothbrush instead of folding it nicely? Okay, you want to go that way? That's fine, no problem. We can work that. I can deal with that. I can live with that. Matzah is the symbol of humility. It's the antithesis of hubris. Seor she'be'isa is what the Gemara says is like the symbol of the evil inclination of the Yetzer Hara, because it's all about arrogance. It's about the puffed up sense of self. I'm a big person. What do you mean? You stood in line in front of me at the Jewel? Do you know who I am? Are you kidding? Do you know who I am? The huge I is what gets us in trouble all the time. That's why if you look in the Sefer Or HaTzadikim, they say that the root of all midos, ra'os of all evil, is gaiva. If you look at the Rambam tells you that you got to be a middle-of-the-road kind of person, right? You got to be a middle-of-the-road kind of person, except in two areas, and they're correlated. You have to be an extremist. The Rambam advocates extremism and fundamentalism when it comes to gaiva, hubris, arrogance, and anger, kas. Now, obviously, those are two related dimensions, because when do we get frustrated and angry? When my expectations are not met. I expected that project would be done on time. My kid was going to do this for me. My mother-in-law was going to say that to me. I was expecting something. When I don't get that, I get upset. So says the Rambam, you have to go to the absolute opposite extreme. You have to be a crazy extremist when it comes to gaiva. So we become crazy extremists. And I like to try to remember this when I look for chametz in my house. I'm not just looking for crumbs. Abosai, I'm looking in my head to say, wait a minute. This is the symbol. This reminds me that the Seor she'be'isa, the arrogance inside each of us, every time that I'm looking for chametz, I'm thinking to myself, the Rambam's telling me. The Rambam says you have to root out every drop of arrogance. So when we enter into this relationship with God, we eat matzah. We say, you know what? We're going to put ourselves in our place. We're going to put ourselves in check. And maybe this has to do with perhaps the chait of Adam HaRishon, that they ate something they weren't supposed to eat because they wanted to be v'yisim kelohim. This is a whole longer story from Reb Tzadok HaKohen of Lublin, that perhaps, according to one opinion, the Gemara and Sanhedrin, they ate bread. The wheat that grew on trees in the old days before the world went bad was actually loaves of bread that grew on trees. And the Nachash said to Chava, you eat this, you'll be really big, you'll be really important. So we go back to that. The only time we have a mitzvah to eat something specific, we have a lot of mitzvahs to eat, but to eat something specific today, the only biblical mitzvah today is matzah. Maror is derabanan. Matzah is daraisa. So we eat something and we say, when we eat this, we're getting into our relationship with God. It's the birthday of, maybe it's our first date, maybe it's our engagement, whatever you want to call it, that first stage of the relationship. It's like the Sudas Erison. When we do that, we remind ourselves we're focused on the matzah of keeping ourselves in check. That's matzah. Pesach matzah, now maror. Maror is one of the toughest pieces, I find. But at least this year, even though I don't understand the maror, at least I can have, for myself, some perspective on the maror. Maror represents the vicissitudes, the difficult times. And we don't really understand the maror all that well. If somebody comes to you and tells you that they can explain to you why the Holocaust happened, I would say you have two options. They're either a prophet or a liar. Very hard to be anything else. So that's why it was hilarious when Rabbi Linzer, he's asked me the last 2 years to talk to the students in Hello Torah about theology and the Holocaust. I'm like, you are asking the wrong person because I don't have any good answers. What answers do I have? That's the bitterest maror. It's such a bitter maror. But this year, I considered the fact that maror, according to the Rambam, is not an independent mitzvah. Mar is never a mitzvah that stands by itself. Today, Mar is only a rabbinic mitzvah. Why? Because Mar, without the Korban Pesach, it's not a mitzvah. It doesn't stand alone. So I found two essays, also on Torah Web, by Rabbi Michael Rosenzweig and Rabbi Meir Twersky, two Rosh Yeshiva at YU, who both speak to the fact that although maybe we don't always understand the suffering in the world, it's always part of a process. Do we see the process? Sometimes yes, sometimes no. It exists communally and individually. Do we always understand the Mara? Does the Mara stand alone? No, it doesn't. And not only that, we don't make a Hatova HaMeitiv on the Mara. We make a Bracha Al Achilas Mara. Just like when, God forbid, something tragic happens, we say the Bracha of Dynamis. We don't say Shechianu. We call it bitter. But we believe that the bitterness is part of the Pesach. It doesn't stand alone. That's part of our faith. That's part of the faith. Rav Yatz tells an incredible story here about, and there are many more stories like this, of Jews who observed the Seder and the Holocaust. It's very bitter. It's very bitter. I don't have any good explanation. But for God's standpoint, especially in the philosophy of Rav Soloveitchik, suffering and sacrifice is a step toward redemption. Do we always understand it? Do we know why we spent all that time in Egypt? Different people offer different rationales of what we took away from it. But at the end of the day, God had a plan that was part of the plan for the Pesach, for the redemption, for giving us Yetzias Mitzrayim. We don't shy away from looking at the Mar and saying that it is bitter. But we look at it, we realize that God runs the world. Monotheism says it all comes from God. Do we see it easily? No. So Rabbi Yudin, a rabbi from Fairlawn before he used to come, Rabbi Benjamin Yudin used to say, he said once, forget from whom, when you say Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad, Hashem and Elokeinu are two different modes of God working in the world. Hashem is Rachamim, it's mercy, and Elokeinu is Din, it's judgment, it's catastrophe. So you know what we do? We say it's Hashem Echad. We believe it's the same God. We don't bifurcate. But you know, sometimes we need to close our eyes. We need to cover it up. We need to cover our eyes because we don't see it. I don't see how the same God who is benevolent is also strict. But we believe it. That's part of Shema Yisrael. So even though we don't see it, we believe it. And that's part of dealing with the Maror as part of the Seder, is seeing that that's part of God's plan, even if we don't understand it. Okay, three more points.
Oh, Rabbi Graham.
Yeah.
Can we also, part of this is teaching the kids, and I don't remember where we came up with this, but we told the kids that Maror is the bitterness, just like you see maybe an ugly side of your daddy when you're being disciplined. And this was like another symbol, and kind of bring it more to terms, just for retelling the story at their level. But there's also another side to mommy and daddy that, you know, when you get what you want, or whatever it is, that the kids think that you're glorious, not to compare God with your parents, but again, at their level, for them to kind of understand.
Absolutely, I think that's a great idea. Because in truth, before I went to Hillel Torah, I called Dr. Pelkovitz, who's my Moreh Horah when it comes to psychology. So I said to him, I said, well, what am I going to tell these kids? They're in eighth grade, so developmentally, what can they wrap their head around in terms of theodicy? You know, what am I supposed to tell these kids? You know, Rabbi Lindzer is putting me on the spot, and then he's going to videotape it and show it in front of 500 people. Like, man, this is crazy. So, yes, I think the pattern of Avinu Malkeinu, of strictness, that certainly has a place, and I think that's a good piece of it. And I think that's very good for children, especially at the level that they can understand. I think for us, let's say the Piasetzner Rebbe, who's living in Warsaw, and he's delivering the sermons of the Holy Fire, the Ish Kodesh, and he tells the people, he says, Ribbono Shel Olam, he says, you think it's good what the Nazis are doing to us? It's no good because we can't daven, because we can't learn. So our Avodas Hashem is wrecked because of this. And then he says, you know, I can't understand. Could this be Schar V'Onesh? Maybe it's just Yisurin Shel Ava. It's like Rabbi Akiva. It's very high, lofty levels. He said, I don't really understand this. So I think, yes, on one level, a lot of the things that happen, we can deal with on that level. But I think we shouldn't even be scared. We shouldn't be afraid to be able to deal with even the harder things. Maybe not at the Seder. Maybe this is not the time to have like the whole Holocaust discussion. But I think just in terms of, for us, how do we deal with things? We shouldn't be afraid to ask the question and try to approach it, as long as we're okay that not all the time we have answers. So I would say, I'm talking like way high above, just background. I think that's a great approach for children. Sometimes children get a patch. You know, in some places patch is not PC, but I would believe, certainly when it comes to danger, I'm a big proponent of patches. It's on record. If my kid runs in the street, so he's going to get a patch. Because he has to understand he cannot run in the street. It's pikuach nefesh. So he's going to get a patch. Because that's dangerous. If he's putting his finger in the electric socket, he has to understand. So it's going to hurt. It's going to hurt. So I think that's a good mashal. It's a good mashal for some of the things. I agree with that. So we got Pesach, Matzah, and Maror. Let's continue to section F. B'chol dor v'dor. So now we've actually experienced the symbols. B'chol dor v'dor chayav adam lirus es atzmo ki'ilu hu yatzah mimitzrayim. So there's a whole Torah about the fact that at the night of the Seder, it's the same day of the week as Tisha B'Av. That's correct. And that's why many have the practice, says the Ramah, to put an egg on their Seder plate, because the egg is a symbol of mourning. Like when a person, Rachmana Litzlan, sits Shiva, when they sit down to Shiva, they have a meal called the Sudas Havra, and they eat round things. They eat bagels or eggs. Why are we thinking about Tisha B'Av on the night of the Seder? So there are many different suggestions. I think one of them, to cut to the chase, has to do with what we do on Tisha B'Av. Do you imagine, there's an apocryphal story about Napoleon. I don't think this is true, but maybe it's true. Napoleon walked by a shul one time on the night of Tisha B'Av, and he looked in the shul, and the candles were lit low, and it was dark, and the people were sitting on the floor, and they were crying. So he said to somebody, what are these people doing? They said, they're mourning the temple was destroyed. So he said, when did that happen? They said, 1700 years ago. He said, what? On Tisha B'Av, we sit on the floor like mourners, like avelim. We don't put on tefillin in the morning. We don't wear shoes. All kinds of things that we do for Inhagi Avelis. What are you talking about? Beis HaMikdash was destroyed 1,000,000 years ago. It's old news. But on Tisha B'Av, it's not just a time that we have history. It's a time of memory. And memory is different than history. Because through memory, we re-experience. So every year on Tisha B'Av, it's as if the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed today. So there are people, I don't know if there are communities in America, there are people who will recite the bracha of Dayan HaEmes when they read the Torah on Tisha B'Av. Because it's as if they're tearing their clothes today for the first time. It's that sense of re-experience. Who has a beautiful thesis on this? I don't necessarily agree with this conclusion, but Dr. Yosef Chaim Yerushalmi, a professor from Columbia, has a whole book called Zachor, where he talks about the difference between Jewish history and Jewish memory. It's not a night, the Seder is not a night of history. It's a night of memory. So now you bring it back. Just like on Tisha B'Av, we re-experience it as if it's happening. So too at the Seder night. This is the opposite. Well, though that is the depth of darkness, here we're at the top, the pinnacle of the world. So therefore we say, Chayav Adam Lirus Es Atzmo. I have to see myself, Ki'ilu Hu Yatzam Mitzrayim, as if I'm leaving Egypt now. And that's why we're about to break into song. We don't make a bracha on the Hallel at the Seder, because it's spontaneous. We're not going to wait to say the Hallel after the meal, even though usually you're supposed to say Hallel on a full stomach, because you really have a sense of fulfillment. But we don't wait, because we're saying it out of spontaneous joy. That's why the briskers say there's no bracha. Because we're just feeling that sense of overwhelming gratitude, that liros es atzmo, because it's not about history. It's not telling the kids, this is what happened many, many years ago to a bunch of old people. This is memory. And that memory, we reignite the fire. It's vivid, and we actually act it out with all the different pieces of the puzzle. Two more. We conclude this section of the Haggadah with a bracha in section G. Baruch atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Olam, Asher ga'alanu v'goal es avoseinu mimitzrayim, He who redeemed us and redeemed our fathers from Egypt, v'yonu alayla azeh lecho bo matzah umarar, and He arrived this night to eat matzah and marar. Make sense? Nice bracha? We thank God, we conclude Magid with this closing bracha that says, God redeemed us. Make sense? This is good? You like it? So why do we go on a whole continued rambling? What's the next section? Can somebody read that for us? In section G, it's the third line. Nobody making eye contact. Yeah? Who's going to read it? Go ahead. Perfect. Let's just read that line. Let's translate it. So too, God Yagi Enu. What does that mean, Yagi Enu, somebody? Let us arrive to. Bring us to good times, in peace, holidays. Bring us to those times. We've shifted tenses. Did you notice? We just pulled a fast one. We started referring to the past. And now we're saying what?
Future.
It's about the future. So what happened in this bracha? The answer is this bracha is called cut and paste by the rabbis. The Mishnah of Aseches Pesachim said two rabbis had two ideas. Rabbi Tarfon, he said we make the bracha about Asher Ga'olanu. Rabbi Akiva said, you know, you got to remember one more thing about the Seder. It's about the future. The Seder is about the faith in the redemption for the future. And now we understand why, as a longer discussion, why Rabbi Akiva plays a big role in the Seder. Because all the rabbis, when they were sitting in Bnei Brak, the five rabbis, who's sitting in the middle? Ma'aseh Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Yeshua, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, Rabbi Akiva, and Rabbi Tarfon. The middle, that means he's the most important, because he's sitting at the head of the table. That was Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, because Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah was the chief rabbi at the time. But why were they in Bnei Brak? Because at the Seder table, they wanted to sit with Rabbi Akiva. Because Rabbi Akiva was the one who at the end of Maseches Makos and elsewhere in Shas, he looks at the destroyed Beis HaMikdash under the shadow of the Hadrianic persecutions. He looks at the Beis HaMikdash that all the rabbis are crying and
he laughs.
He says, don't worry, because tomorrow will be better. So the rabbis come to Rabbi Akiva. They say, tomorrow will be better. He says, you know what? Even Bar Kokhba, Ben Kuziva, he might be the Mashiach. Married Bar Kokhba, he might be the Mashiach. Because I insist on looking at the future. No matter how bleak it's going to be, no matter the fact that they're going to comb my flesh and kill me, Al Kiddush Hashem, with iron combs. I look at the future. So we don't just conclude, says Rav Yatz, with the bracha of Asher Ga'olanu. We make sure we also say Al Kain. We have Rabbi Akiva's optimism that even if the Geula didn't come this year, it could come next year. And the last point is the notion of Halal. We conclude our Seder with halal, not just a regular halal. It's called halal hagadol because we add hodu l'Hashem, the 26 hodus, and we say nishmas kol chai. The Gemara says in Brachas, if you say halal every single day, you're a blasphemer. It's terrible. You know why? Because it's like any relationship. If I come home and every night it's going to be, I don't know, an anniversary dinner with flowers and roses and chocolates, so after a couple of weeks, it's nice at first, it's going to get very stale. So every night you have to come home and say thank you to all the people in our life. You got to say thank you, especially someone makes dinner for you, they take care of you, you have to say thank you. Every day we have a mitzvah of Zechiras Yetzias Mitzrayim. You say thank you every single day. But Pesach is anniversary. It's not just another dinner time. It's the anniversary, like we said, of the original founding of this relationship. So tonight, we say Halal Hagadol. Once a year, we say Halal at night. It's the only time, really, that we say Halal at night. Because tonight we're feeling that sense of renewal of the relationship. It's like an anniversary. So for an anniversary dinner, you go all out. You go to the fanciest restaurant you can find, as much as you can afford, and do everything that we can possibly do to invest in this relationship and to say how much we appreciate it. That's halal, and that's why it's halal hagadol. It's a special halal tonight because it's the time that we really reflect on all that God has done for us from the beginning of the time all the way until today, and please God, moving forward. I wish everybody, thank you for coming. Chag Kosher V'Sameach.
Thank you.